The next paper, which I also think is going to be very interesting, and I'm going to make it easier for myself, I'm just going to say Dr. Peter. And the title of her paper is Babel Boot Camp, Preventing Speech and Language Disorders in Infants at Genetic Risk.
Okay, hi, my name is Beata Peter, and if you think the name is weird, wait till you hear what I do for a living. I look for genetic causes of speech, language, and reading disorders, and then I'm looking for ways to translate the knowledge that we gain about the genotype-phenotype association into clinical practice to hopefully improve outcomes. First, let's talk a little bit about how kids learn to talk. This is baby Eddie, and he's going to show you how a newborn cries. So what did he do? He forced some air through his adducted vocal folds, which start to vibrate. And this is a Bernoulli effect at work. And that makes a sound, a buzzing sound, and that sound is being modulated by the shape of the oral cavity. In this case, baby Eddie opened his mouth, wah, and he had his tongue low and his lips wide open, and out comes something that sounds like the vowel, ah, no consonants yet. This is baby Eddie at age a year old. Actually, this is called variegated babble. He knows how to make not just one consonant, but two. He's making a b and a g sound. He knows how to make two vowels, an a and an a. He is progressing. He's progressing towards speech. This is a little bit older, a year and a half. This is called gibberish. Eddie imitating elements of speech. He's getting closer and closer. So far, he hasn't said anything yet that means anything. There is a stage where children use just one word to communicate. They might say shoe. When they're about 18 months old, they combine two words and they might say daddy shoe. And they could mean daddy help me with my shoes, or what I see there is daddy's shoe. It's like the next level of complexity. This is Eddie's sister Linnea when she was about 2.5. Could you understand her?
Once upon a time.
Yeah, once upon a time, she's telling a pretend story. At 2.5, she has enough speech sounds and enough words to communicate lots more of complex ideas. This is Eddie at 5 now.
So, it's all the sentences that the new galaxy. The new galaxy of the other galaxies inside of the universe. And the universe is
Could you understand him? Does he have all of his speech sounds down? No, he doesn't have the interdental fricatives yet. No one knows if yeah or not, but we can still understand him at age 5. The rule is everybody should pretty much understand what a child says, regardless if you know the child or if you know what the child is doing at the moment. At age 5, speech should be completely clearly understandable. That's not the case for children with severe speech sound disorders. This child is also 5 years old.
I don't know. Do you call it that?
A telephone.
A telephone.
Could you understand what she said before she said telephone? I could not either. I needed mom's help. This child has a very, very severe speech sound disorder. She's not intellectually challenged. She is just challenged in the motorics of the speech process. Here is a video of a little boy, age 4, and he has a similar problem. This child could not say lofty, he said opi. He could not say stars, he said ah. He could not say glasses, he said ah. And for slide, he said I. This child has a very severe speech sound disorder. He hardly has any consonants at all at age 4. Very, very severely disordered. Speech language disorders are not rare. Speech disorders occur in about 4% of 6-year-old children. Severe speech disorders of the Noun syndrome account, for instance, of childhood apraxia of speech, less than 1% of school-aged children, and language impairment, 7 to 10% of school-aged children. Speech and language disorders are not cheap. Kids with severe disorders need many years of intense weekly therapy to the tune of $200 an hour, roughly. Access to education is sometimes an issue. I've been a speech pathologist in a public school where some children with severe speech disorders were excluded because others could not understand them. There are social perceptions of individuals with speech problems. There's bullying that people experience. But perhaps the biggest cost is the frustrations for the child and the whole family because the child is unable to communicate ideas so that others can understand. This little boy, and I'm going to save the time to play this, I'll just tell you, this is a little boy, the same one you saw before, who's trying to tell his dad something and the dad doesn't understand and says, let's just stop and go home. So that is a very, very high cost of having a severe speech sound disorder. What is childhood apraxia of speech? It's a small subtype of speech sound disorders. We've probably all seen kids who can't make an L or R or the S sound. Childhood apraxia of speech is a neurological speech disorder that interferes with motor planning or motor programming of the articulators. It's fairly rare, about 1% of kids. It's very severe, requires a lot of therapy and highly trained specialized therapy at that. It's often comorbid with dyslexia. It can occur as part of many syndromes as well as being non-syndromic. So Rolandic epilepsy is an example, and autism spectrum disorder, especially for kids who have deletions on chromosome 16p11.2, can have either autism or apraxia of speech or both. And so the genetic etiologies are being slowly discovered. I'm one of those people who are working in that area. And in non-syndromic forms, we know it's highly heterogeneous, and the genes of interest seem to be relevant for cerebellar structures and functions. I'll play you a very brief video of an 18-year-old who has childhood apraxia of speech. Can't get this to work, that's okay. I'll just tell you that she's trying to move her mouth to make a word and she can't find the right place for her tongue and for her lips to make that word. So I'll just let you briefly read these statements that parents have told me. Of particular interest is the statement that I'm highlighting here in red. One mom told me that if she had known how hard it would be, she has 3 children, all with speech sound disorder of this very severe kind and accompanying fine motor and gross motor problems, she said she wouldn't have had any more children if she had known how hard this would be. And just as a take note of this statement, as we discover more and more causal genes, it will become possible to do prenatal testing for these genes, and it will become more and more possible for parents to opt not to carry such a child to term. Just for take that away as one of the underlying motivations for some of this work. So what do we typically do when children have speech and language disorders? We wait until they show symptoms of the disorder. And what this looks like in terms of timeline, a child with a very, very severe apraxia of speech will already not babble, typically, like Eddie was doing. They will have delayed onset of first words, delayed onset of sentences. The first assessment occurs, however, by around age 24 months, and treatment will begin between ages 24 and 36 months, and then speech will start to emerge, but some of these children, like the 18-year-old young woman that I was trying to show you but couldn't, it will persist for a very, very long time. So dreaming of a different way. What if we could diagnose children at birth? What if we could help them with the very, very earliest building blocks of speech? What if we could initiate treatment much earlier and work on sentences, on vocabulary, and achieve much, much better outcomes? This is a dream. The case in point is classic galactosemia, which is a genetic disorder caused by a mutation on chromosome 9 and the GALT gene. And how it works is individuals who are lacking the enzyme produced by that gene are unable to digest lactose. And this leads to a buildup of galactose in the blood, which is toxic to many organ systems, including neurons. It's discovered via newborn screening. And what is already known is that nearly all children with this kind of a homozygous mutation will end up in the speech pathologist's office for very, very severe speech sound disorders and very, very severe language disorders. The girl I was trying to show you has galactosemia. And the phenotypes are very severe. If not treated immediately with restricting lactose intake, can be fatal, and there is effects on multiple organ systems. And as I said, deficits in speech and language is what we pick out to work on. You would think that because these children's risk for speech and language disorders are known at birth, why don't we do something right away? But strangely, that is not being done at the moment clinically. Insurances won't cover this kind of thing. School districts won't accept that kind of a child as a patient. We did a Facebook survey of 22 families with kids who have classic galactosemia, and we found that the mean age of screening does not differ from any typical kid. And the mean age of start of therapy also does not differ from any other child with the disorder. Only 5 of the children surveyed had typical Babbitt behaviors. So that leads us to wonder, babies with classic galactosemia tend to not vocalize or babble much. Will teaching them to babble help their speech development? Nobody knows. First words and sentences appear late and are underdeveloped. Will attention to words and sentences very, very early on help communication outcomes in the long run? Nobody's tried this. Besides the risk for speech and language disorders, there's also a risk for cognitive delays. Will a focus on communication skill also spill over to cognitive development? No one knows, and we are trying to find out some answers here. The idea is the Babbel Bootcamp. It is a pilot study, and we hire a speech language pathologist to train parents to help their babies with Babbel. Usually they're very, very quiet. Parents are being trained to elicit and build up and support cooing, Babbel, first word sentences, and using language to convey meanings. The active phase of our study runs from ages 2 to 24 months. This is long before they typically even get assessed. And some of our concepts that we focus on, we teach these babies to imitate, which is a crucial skill when you're teaching a very young child anything. And we're teaching parents to operate just one step ahead of their babies so they're not talking over their babies' heads, but to stay closely engaged. Now, we have these infants with classic galactosemia and their parents in our study. We have 11 families. On Tuesday, I'll be talking to the 12th family, hopefully. And we use a recording device that the babies get in the mail. We put it on a vest on them, and it records 16 hours straight. And there is software that can analyze things like infant vocalization syllables that infants produce. The adults in the background, it analyzes a lot of the acoustics. We pay attention to quantity and quality of babble, speech sound accuracy, vocabulary growth, sentence growth, cognitive development, and importantly, quality of life. How do you work with little babies? So let's say the baby is making a cooing sound. We train parents to respond to that, make a conversation out of cooing. The baby is making a gesture, respond to the gesture. Engage in joint attention, look at the same thing together. Provide labels and models of language. The baby is pointing to something, you tell them what it is that they're pointing to. All in all, this is the full program that we fleshed out for our various grant proposals, and it's very well thought out. Some of the activities the adults do, like operant conditioning, the baby is making a babble sound, the adult turns on a light, And the babies love that, and they want to babble more because they want to see the light more. That's just one example. Here is our list of data that we are taking and planning to take across the whole entire study. When the babies are 36 months old and 48 months old, we do standardized testing. That's where we look for proof that our program worked. Pilot results. Recently, a few of the infants turned 12 months old, and it seems that the babies in the treatment group, we have one control baby and four treatment babies that turned a year old recently. The babies in the treatment group are vocalizing more than the control baby, and their vocabulary is emerging well as well. So this graph shows you, it's a little complicated, my colleague Mark Van Damme made it. On the x-axis, you see vocabulary emergence as a percentile. And our treatment babies are in blue over here, and you see that their vocabulary development is very, very much higher than our control baby. In the black, you see some typical babies, and they're sort of all over the place. But the difference between our treatment babies and the control baby is very evident, even though the numbers are tiny, of course. On the two white axes are two different measures of volume of vocalizations. How many syllables per hour did you produce? And the blue babies are very, very much ahead of the game compared to the control baby and some of the typical babies who didn't get that encouragement to babble more. Pilot results also from questionnaires that we give. We give them, the parents, the ages and stages 3 to fill out, and we have several rough estimators. Especially interesting is the area of problem solving, which is an estimate of IQ, and the four treated babies are doing fine. The control baby is not doing fine. Here's an example of what happens when we teach parents to use Babbel to build the precursors of conversation. This parent has learned how to make a conversation with her baby, and this parent is meeting the baby right where the baby is. The baby is still doing reduplicative babble, ba 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 ba. Mom stimulates it, the baby babbles back. Mom goes up one little step up the ladder and gives the baby a variegated babble model to see if the baby wants to imitate that one. The baby is trying to but can't quite do it, but that's how we build the babble vocabulary for these babies. It's awesome. This baby is doing very, very well. And our next steps for the whole entire project are we need bigger samples. Right now we're operating on a shoestring budget from the university, from Arizona State University. We've applied for various grants now. And we need two control groups. One is infants with classic galactosemia who do not receive the Babbel boot camp, and typical babies who are being very, very closely observed but also do not receive the treatment. We are shooting for 25 families in each group. We want to build this out to age 4 years at least. And we also want to consider branching out into other populations. For instance, families who have galactosemia, who have apraxia of speech for other reasons. I already have several families in mind that have come to me for research projects. And we have one family that has 5 children with severe apraxia of speech. The 6th baby was just born, and that baby is going into the Babbel boot camp. And they do not have galactosemia. We just want to see if we can generalize effects to other cases too. We want to also eventually find out what is the magic ingredient in the study. I want to just round it out by pointing to the big picture here. We're constantly always looking for genetic etiologies of speech, language, and reading disorders, but that doesn't mean anything unless we make the results actionable. So far, nobody's really done much in terms of translating this into clinical practice. We want to do this. We want to find ways to identify babies at genetic risk early, and we want to create preventive treatment approaches for them so that we could say, oh, you have a newborn diagnosis of something, galactosemia, something else we already know in your family, you have a FOXP2 mutation, so let's put you in the Babbel boot camp and make your life go so much better when it comes to speech and language. You've heard of precision medicine. We think of this as precision practice. Recently, I've been speaking with people in my new world of behavior genomics, and when I talk with them, they say, oh, you mean you're working on a phenotype that you can actually influence? Yeah. And the Thresher Foundation, where we've applied for funding, they said initially, well, we only fund medical research, drug research. We don't fund behavioral research. But they got very interested in our project, said, well, actually, your approach may be behavioral, but the condition is medical, and the outcome that you're targeting is very, very relevant. So they're very interested in our study. Finally, going back to the mom who said she wouldn't have had any more kids if she had known how hard it was, our answer would be, in the future, we hope to give you more effective approaches for families like yours. We want to give parents hope for better clinical outcomes. Speech sound disorders are not new. And by going into the world of prevention in our field is going to a new frontier. I've shown you that standard practice in our field is reactive. It is post-diagnostic. When the child already shows delays in speech and language, that's when we can become active. Our approach is approaching a new frontier with prevention using behavioral strategies. With that, I want to acknowledge my collaborators and my students and their students and point out to you in the background of the lab picture is a painting that shows a cityscape. This painting was created by a young woman, age 15 years old, who became one of the world's first people to receive a genetic diagnosis at TGen, the Translational Research Institute in Phoenix, Arizona. She had a severe motor disease. She was like a little girl with severe advanced Parkinson's disease. She was nonverbal and was in a wheelchair. And the geneticist at TGen did a complete genome sequence for her and both parents and discovered that she has a de novo mutation in a gene that is in the dopamine pathway. So they gave her dopamine medication. Within 3 months, she was out of the wheelchair and started to talk. So I analyzed her speech and language, and she discovered that she's actually an artist. So in our department, we threw an art show for her that we called Expressions by Shelby. She can now express herself verbally as well as through art. And she is a poster child of where I would hope that our field could go, that the world of speech and language, the ability to express ourselves, we could harness knowledge of genetics toward better effective interventions. That's where I want to go with my research. These are my references, and now I'm open for questions.
Questions? Sure. First of all, I presume you, by definition, make it clear that these patients don't have any hearing problem, that it's not a receptive issue.
Very, very good question. All of these people have intact hearing. That's the very, very first thing that we check. And that's something that's even checked through newborn hearing screening. And the input is never the problem. We would not take a child like that into our program.
I just wonder, is it clear that, well, it depends, I suppose, where you measure in the brain, whether the sound's getting there, but how receptive it is in terms of how it's interpreted.
Yeah, so that's a very good question as well. So we can measure receptive language ability even in someone who cannot speak. And all of these people have intact receptive language, so that tells us that their auditory system is functioning on all levels. It is the output side that's affected.
Why do you think, presumably parents will talk to their children without necessarily babbling at them. Why does the babbling work when just talking to the child doesn't work? Is it that it's just too sophisticated for them to even try to duplicate, or why would that be?
Well, of course the parents will talk to their children with regular language like all parents do, but the babies are supposed to learn to babble. They're not babbling on their own. Their parents are teaching them to babble. And so we know that in general, in typical children, the ones that have a huge amount of babble and very sophisticated babble using lots of different consonants, 2, 3, 4 years down the line, they will have advanced speech and language skills. So the babble seems to be predictive of future speech and language ability. And we're trying to tweak that babble screw in these babies to see if we kick it into gear, will this become a motoric building block for speech and language later on?
Related to this question right here. So the part of the brain that's affected, is it a motor cortex issue or a Broca's area where speech begins to be formed? Do you know where it's localized?
Well, some of the newer research seems to point to, of all things, the cerebellum. There's other places, of course, too, like the basal ganglia, but there's recent research that shows that the cerebellum plays a huge role in linguistic and cognitive processing, not just motor. And so that's interesting to me. I'm seeing the genes that I'm finding as genes of interest. If I look at their expression patterns throughout the lifespan, the cerebellar cortex and the cerebellar vermis are oftentimes implicated in some of these genes. The true answer to your question, though, is unknown. It's not really that clear which areas in the brain completely control all of this.
Sorry, at the beginning of your talk, you talked about the different stages. Are there developmental windows for these stages? So if you miss that window, it's much more difficult to catch up later?
That's also a great question. And you know, Shelby is the poster child for the answer. She did not speak until she was 10 years old. In my knowledge, this is the latest that any child has ever been delayed. There are other kids who were trached at birth and they were decannulized at age 24 months or 36. And what happens in their case when they do start to speak, they go through the exact same sequence as a typical kid very, very early on. Shelby, when she was 12 years old, she could not make a k and g sound. She said, "I did that," like a typically developing 3-year-old. When she was 15, she did not have L and R, just like a typical developing 5-year-old. She was 5 years delayed. But that R, I don't know what's doing. I haven't seen her in a while, but yeah, that's a very, very interesting question.
So if you correct the galactosemia, why doesn't that correct the speech disorder?
That's a really great question as well. So Jerry Berry, who does some of the molecular work on galactosemia, seems to think that a lot of the brain functions and structures are being affected even prenatally. And so when the babies are born, they already have a strike against them, even though they've never even had one sip of mother's milk. So there's something that he thinks is going on prenatally. And once we, if babies do get galactose post-birth, they can have devastating effects very quickly. But if you restrict this, then they will still have certain struggles across their lifespan. There's no more questions. Thank you very much for your interest in this talk. Appreciate it.
Thank you.